This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether learning about the family dynamics of pandas or watching another Shark Week special, nature programs do their best to play to our human appetites. There's an essential part of the natural world that does not fit into the favorite topics of cuddly and cute or violent and predatory, a subject that even nature shows tend to steer clear of. Reproduction. In the new PBS show Sex in the Wild, host and comparative biologist Dr. Joy Rydenburg explores the sexuality of four very different mammals: elephants, orangutans, dolphins, and kangaroos. Joy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I suppose we ought to start the interview with a similar warning that you have on the program, which is to say this is not a show that shies away from the action, let's say.
But I wouldn't warn people to stay away from it or worry about protecting their children from it, because I actually think learning about nature is something that everybody should do at pretty much every age. It's not something that I would shy away from, and I certainly would allow my kids to see something like this.
Many times on nature shows, you know, when the act is about to begin, the camera steers away.
Well, sometimes you get a glimpse of it, but they don't really explain anything. That's the problem. So people understand that animals can be attached to each other for sexual purposes, but nobody seems to understand what's actually happening. And one thing I absolutely hate about how people describe the talk that they have with their children is they'll say, well, we have to talk about the birds and the bees. And I'm thinking, boy, do they really need to watch this show, because birds and bees don't have any of the right body parts. You're certainly looking at the wrong animals for your examples.
Okay, so educational as well as interesting. Let's talk first about the elephants. That's the first animal that you investigate on the show. Elephants, yes. It turns out, have very strong family relationships. Tell us how these bonds play into sexual reproduction.
Well, the most important thing about those bonds is that these animals are very, very protective of the new baby that's born. And remember, sexual reproduction isn't just the mating act. It's the entire reproductive cycle, mating, the pregnancy, the birth, the nursing afterwards, and the care of that newborn until it becomes an independent, mature animal. So one of the things that you really, really understand about elephants when you see their interactions is how protective they are of that baby. The social bonds are extremely strong when it comes to that. And there is a scene in there where we show a pack of wild dogs that came in and bothered the elephants while they're at a watering hole. And the mature animals were very, very nervous about the fact that they had a baby with them and didn't want the wild dogs anywhere near it. And they started chasing these dogs all over the place to get them away from that baby. And you could just see how strong that protective instinct is with these animals.
Well, despite all of that tenderness, elephants actually mating is a pretty rough spectacle. Tell us a little bit about the mating process and some of the elephant spectators.
Yes, the elephant mating scene is funny in many ways because you've got a very public mating. All of the other elephants are standing around watching the whole thing happen. And in fact, they're not just watching it. They're actually advertising it to any other male that might be in the area. So as soon as the two that are involved in the mating start to begin to mate, you've got all the other animals starting to trumpet very loudly and making a whole big pandemonium scene, basically saying, hey, if you're out there and you want to mate, now's your time because she's ready. And, you know, we've got one here, but if you think you're better, you better head this way.
Wow.
So it's actually quite a funny scene when you think about it. It's far from a private event as we would normally think of mating to be.
There is a scene in the elephant episode that alludes to that. In this case, one of your colleagues is helping to collect semen from a sedated elephant.
Right.
There's a sense that he and the other professionals around him cannot suppress the occasional laugh at the circumstances. So let's hear from that.
God, it's like a bloody rodeo. That's incredible. Oh, that's amazing. You're beginning to see now the full length of his penis. Can you give us a sense of how big it is?
Well, this is going to
I'm glad you're all laughing at this. I know you've done it before and I haven't, but this is it.
You thought we were joking.
I genuinely thought you were having me on.
So what about it, Joy? When you were conceiving of making the show and thinking about viewers watching it, were you thinking that the urge to giggle may be part of the appeal?
Oh, I think anytime anybody talks about sex, the urge to giggle is always there. Even us right now are thinking about it and laughing. Even as that clip was just playing, I heard some giggling from the background there. So I think that we all have a side to us that's a bit embarrassed about sex. And sometimes we express that with a giggle. And because we don't really know how it does respond otherwise, because culturally there's so many taboos about sex. But in fact, we should be fascinated with it. It should be one of those things that urges us on to explore more about. And in fact, as we mature, we tend to be much more excited about investigating it than we are when we're younger. So when you talk about sex to younger children, if they're very young, they don't have all of that cultural taboo. They don't giggle and shy away from it. In fact, if you give them the words right away when they're young, they use the words appropriately to describe different parts of their body. But as those children start to mature and they get to about middle school age, all of a sudden the giggles set in big time. So yes, I think we knew that people would giggle. They might feel a little bit nervous about seeing a scene like that. But it actually is also a bit of a funny scene. Independent of the fact that we are talking about sexual organs, it's a very funny scene because even though the animal is sedated, the penis starts moving on its own, which is something that was totally unexpected. So when you're trying to get a semen sample from the penis to try to determine whether a contraceptive is working, which was part of a very serious scientific investigation on how to control elephant populations, and all of a sudden the specimen you're trying to get is coming from an organ that's moving around independently, that does evoke a lot of laughter.
Well, that's one of the things that struck me, how different their reproductive and especially gestational biology is from our own. Do you think, Joy, that we tend to project our own sexuality and reproduction onto the animal kingdom?
I think whenever we look at animals and try to understand them, we project our own behaviors and our own physical attributes. And we try to understand if these animals are like us or different from us, because we don't really have a lot else to compare with. We know ourselves the best. So when we talk about elephant gestation, for example, they have the longest gestation of any animal. It's about 2 years. It's technically between 21 and 22 months. That's a long time. And of course, the first thing that comes to our mind is, wow, we thought our pregnancy was long.
We're speaking with Dr. Joy Reidenberg. She's a comparative biologist, and she is host of the new PBS program, Sex in the Wild. So many other species to move on to. One reason it might be uncomfortable for people to learn about animal sexuality is that we understand sex is beyond reproduction, you know, the element of pleasure. Do the mammals covered in sex in the wild exhibit the same joy of sex that humans do?
I think some of them do. And the next episode that's airing this Wednesday is actually focused on orangutans, which are primates like ourselves. They're great apes. And they actually exhibit a lot of behaviors that are very similar to humans. For example, you'll see masturbation. That's something you don't often see in the wild.
So do dolphins, which was a surprise to me. Dolphins, as a species, have also had to adapt methods for reproducing underwater. Talk to us about how their environment dictates their sexual biology.
Well, dolphins have an amazing feat to perform underwater. So unlike land animals, these guys don't have the advantage of using gravity. So you can't have a female in a stable position and then mount that female and be able to thrust against her. Instead, they're dealing with all of these underwater phenomena. So they have a weightless environment. They're moving at the same time that they're mating. So these animals are swimming at high speed and mating while they're swimming at high speed. The male has to be inverted under the female. So he's holding his breath the whole time that he's chasing after her. So he has to do that in addition to the sexual act. And probably I find the most interesting difference is that whales and dolphins have a penis that's actually hidden inside the body until they need it. Because if the penis was sticking out of the body like it does in other mammals, they wouldn't be very streamlined. It'd be very hard for them to swim in the water with all of that friction. So they keep it hidden inside. But that means that when they're ready to mate, they have to extend it. But that requires an ability to extend it instantly because they only have a few seconds to perform the mating act while they're swimming at high speed. So really what we're dealing with is a spring-loaded penis. And so I find that to be the most interesting of their adaptations is this coiled-up penis that can be, you know, just extended just instantly the second they need it for what amounts to about 2 to 3 seconds of mating, and then it's withdrawn again so that they continue to swim without the friction against their body.
Oh, you're going to have to forgive my relapses of, you know, 10-year-old kind of behavior.
Oh, I think we're all going to be laughing. I can imagine people listening to the show are probably laughing right now about the idea of having a spring-loaded penis.
Okay, let's move on to the kangaroos. Many listeners will know about the pouch that marsupials use to carry their young, but may be surprised to discover that kangaroos can be perpetually pregnant. Can you explain how that works?
Well, kangaroos, I think, really got it right when you deal with reproduction. They have a completely different system because they're marsupials, which means that they only develop the fetus inside the uterus for a very, very short time, about a month. Then they deliver that fetus, and that fetus is really not exactly what we would call a fetus. Only the front end looks like a fetus. The back end of it still looks like an embryo, so it's kind of a weird little thing that can actually crawl with its front legs up along the fur of the mother until it reaches the pouch. It then dives into this pouch, and then it latches onto one of her teats, and it suckles. So this little creature is actually about the size of a jelly bean. So they're giving birth to a tiny little thing. Now, I tell you, I'm extremely jealous of kangaroos because I wish I could have given birth to a jelly bean. That would have been easy. No labor pain involved in that at all. And then have the rest of the development, instead of going through an umbilical cord to a placenta, where you can have all kinds of issues with development if the placenta has insufficiency and so on and so forth, instead, it's getting all of its nutrition by breastfeeding in a pouch where you could basically open up the pouch and check on it. So if there's anything going wrong, you could go in there and fix it. But that also means that if times get rough for these animals, like if there's no food around, they can actually pull that baby out, perform a self-abortion. Now, I know that's hard for people to hear, but that's a natural way. That way the mother can survive until times are better in the desert. And then what happens is she's got another baby waiting in suspended animation inside her uterus, ready to be delivered. So these animals constantly are having one baby in the pouch that they're nursing. They have one baby in suspended animation in the uterus waiting to go. And in addition, they might have a third one that's actually out of the pouch that still pokes its head in once in a while to nurse, but it's not actually living inside the pouch.
It is absolutely fascinating. And as you're pointing out, you know, sometimes seemingly cold-blooded to us, it's difficult, I think, in many ways to have an intelligent, you know, open discourse about mating rites and rituals in the course of nature. It's especially difficult for many people in the bedroom. Are we ready for sex in the wild?
Oh, absolutely. I think we are. Because the more we understand about how animals in the wild are reproducing, the more we appreciate what we do and how what we do might be different, or even what we do that is similar. But we would be hopefully less embarrassed about it because we realize this is very natural. One of the things that I think is really important about understanding animal reproduction in the wild is that underneath all of this interest in animal reproduction is a conservation message. One of the things that we are concerned about is protecting species, especially those that are on the brink of survival. And in order for that species to survive, it must reproduce. It must make the next generation. And while we might understand what their needs are in terms of setting aside habitat so that they have the appropriate foods or the appropriate territories to roam, what we don't really understand is what their reproductive needs are. If we can understand that better, they will give us more opportunity to conserve those opportunities these animals need to have sex in the wild.
Dr. Joy Rydenburg is host at the new PBS show Sex in the Wild, which airs on Wednesday nights. We do have links to a website where you can watch some previews online and check your local listings. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Joy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay, here's a factoid for you. Elephant bulls in heat, or must, will spend up to 5 months searching for a mate. I think that's tough. Imagine being a tiny crustacean in the vast ocean. Up next, we head to the coast of Maine for a look at copepod courtship. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The way we talk about finding a romantic partner is very much rooted in the human experience of the physical world. Take love is in the air or love at first sight. These idioms assume that feelings are transmitted through air and are cemented using visual cues. Even the expression falling in love assumes gravity. But love is not restricted to our physical reality. For more on that, we head to the coast of Maine.
Finding a mate isn't easy, even when the backdrop to your wooing is as picturesque as the Damariscotta River estuary. Here, halfway up the coast of Maine, pine trees run right down to the salty shoreline. It's in this water, 30 feet down, where our love story begins. Rachel Lastly-Rasher, a biologist at the nearby Darling Marine Center, tosses a cone-shaped net into the water.
The mesh openings are very, very tiny.
That's because what she's trying to catch, the lovers in our story, are copepods.
Copepods are small crustaceans. So if you see one under a microscope, it looks really similar to maybe a small shrimp.
They're as small as a period on a page, and yet their importance is huge. Entire marine food webs depend on them.
Everything wants to eat you when you're a copepod.
Baby fish, tiny shrimp. Lastly, Rasher hauls up the net by hand and pours the contents of the enclosed tapered end into a bucket.
And let's see what we got. Yeah, I think that's a tamara.
A small brown speck, a tamara copepod, glides through the bucket water. And here's the question. In the vast volume of water where copepods live, how does a tiny male speck find a tiny female speck to make more copepods, to keep the food web going? This basic question of copepod courtship kickstarted Lastly Rasher's graduate work back when she was a student at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She used to pack up copepods from this estuary in Maine and ship them overnight to Atlanta for closer examination in this lab, the lab of her former supervisor.
My name is Jeanette Yen. I'm a professor of biology at Georgia Tech.
Yen didn't set out to study copepod mating in her lab. Instead, she was using a microscope camera to visualize how different kinds of copepods eat one another to get at understanding the complexities of the aquatic food web.
You know, it's in the dark, and we have a nice, beautiful green laser beam illuminating the copepods. And we see all the guys going around, and all of a sudden we saw little guys zoom up and they spin around in a dance.
It happened again and again, one copepod closing in on another copepod, and then the two of them pirouetting through the water. But this wasn't an interaction between a predator and its prey. It turned out these two copepods were a mating pair, a male pursuing a female.
He speeds up, grabs her. And we found out that he was following her trail. Exactly.
It happens in a flash on the screen, but it's still obvious. Every turn, every arc she makes in the water, he retraces. It's not a beeline approach.
So then we played around with this. We made this stuff called copepod tea, where we put all the females in a cup of water and let them perfume it.
Then they took the females out and dripped the perfumed water into a new container holding only males.
And he still followed the trail, so we knew it was a chemical.
In other words, as the female swims, she's leaving behind a tiny filament of scent in the water that lasts for a good 10 seconds. And once the male bumps into it, he races along the trail to find her. That filament is only half the length of a toothbrush, but that's still 100 times bigger than a copepod.
So that increases the encounter rate, and that's why this is a survival tactic for these copepods.
Now, identifying this copepod-come-hither molecule has proven somewhat difficult. The lab needs at least a few million individuals to distill enough of the compound to figure out what it is. The most they've managed to collect so far is a few thousand, and that took 5 people working for a week straight. Still, knowing that copepods produce and respond to a chemical like this is yielding insights into their evolution. Yen says this molecule may help accelerate how quickly new copepod species arise. A simple change in the structure of this chemical could lead to a radically different perfume. So in only a matter of thousands of years, instead of millions of years, you could have 2 new copepod species on your hands, one using the original scent and one using the new scent, and it would all be driven by chemistry.
Yeah, chemistry is everything to them.
Back up in Maine, Rachel Lasley Rasher looks out at the estuary. Beneath the surface, many millions of female copepods thread the water with tiny chemical trails.
I just like thinking about how they're experiencing their physical world, because it's so counterintuitive to our human world. I mean, they're really these millimeter-sized organisms swimming around blind, tasting their world. And I just find that kind of fascinating.
Attraction happens at all scales, between granular animals in a watery world, yes, but also for scientists, human beings with big curiosity, drawn to the tiny things all around them.
And that story brought to us from the radio series Small Matters and producers Ari Daniel and Misa Salita.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's easy to tell the villain in an old Western. The good guy wears a white hat. The bad guy wears black. Real-life villains do not follow that code. We do have the cartoonish image of Snidely Whiplash twirling his mustache with poor Nell tied to the train tracks. But little on the nature, the true nature, of villainy. And why is our culture so absorbed with anti-heroes anyway? Chuck Klosterman is the New York Times ethicist. We spoke to him last year when his book, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined, first came out. The essay collection is now available in paperback. When we spoke, I asked him how he came to define villainy for the purposes of his book.
First of all, when you're trying to write a book like this, when you're kind of working through ideas that are very conceptual, you're always looking for like a unifying field theory. And the closest I come is this idea that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. Now, this is not perfect. There are certainly exceptions to this, some very meaningful. I mean, Hitler is a meaningful exception. Hitler is not someone who knew the most and cared the least. He cared about everything and didn't know anything. But for the most part, you know, what really bothers people is the idea of somebody who just has no emotional investment in what they're doing and yet is sort of effortlessly skilled at manipulating people or sort of controlling society or attaining whatever success that they want. I saw a documentary the other night on Lee Atwater.
Uh-huh.
I really wished I'd written about him because he's almost a perfect example of this. You know, he's this guy who was the architect of the Republican Party through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, did a lot of sort of diabolical things.
He was the Willie – he came up with the Willie Horton campaign, right?
He came up with the Willie Horton campaign. He would sometimes just blatantly lie about people's like – past mental illness or whatnot, you know, a lot of problematic things that within the context of politics were not only acceptable but very successful. But the most interesting thing about this guy to me is that he became a Republican arbitrarily. When he was a young man, he knew he was interested in politics and just saw more traction on the conservative side of the spectrum. If it had been reversed, if the nature of America had been different, he would have become, you know, a Democrat. And to me, that's like the ultimate manifestation of this kind of theory, the idea that this person who understood politics so well, he knew he could succeed and yet had no interest in really being engaged what that success meant.
And they're the people with the kind of swagger. I mean, Lee Atwater is a really great example of it. There's a kind of cynicism in choosing sides just based on what he thinks he can get out of it. And there's a special attention that you pay to those who aspire to villainy, the Aleister Crowleys, and the late 1980s hip-hop band N.W.A., whose real name and most famous song we can't say on the radio.
You know, there is a difference, though, between like an Aleister Crowley character and N.W.A. The fact of the matter is Aleister Crowley actually believed he had to do all these evil things in order to, I guess, be authentically villainous. Like, you know, when he was a young boy, he once killed a cat in 9 different ways, the same cat, just to test the theory of does a cat really have 9 lives? You know, he believed he had to eat all the drugs. He believed he had to push his mother-in-law down a flight of stairs because she represented this idea, this concept that he had to be against. What's different with NWA or, say, the Oakland Raiders of the 1970s or perhaps even someone like Andrew Dice Clay is that they aspired to have the perception of villainy. They saw the kind of the utility in being against whatever the culture was. It's, you know, it's very strange because when someone is a villain on purpose, people don't really believe them. They see it more like a theatrical move.
It works in some places, I guess, in others. And that's one of the things I kind of took away from this book, that a Muhammad Ali, for example, he comes away as the sort of beloved character, while Joe Frazier, who worked himself up from, what, the cotton field, becomes the despised one. Why so fickle?
Well, you know, it's really like a good question. Can I totally explain it? I can't, but I find it very fascinating. I find it fascinating that Muhammad Ali, during his kind of three defining fights against Frazier, used incredible racist language against Frazier and basically positioned him as a black fighter fighting for white America. With Ali, it's particularly complicated because outside of this window, he's probably the most important athlete of the 20th century in terms of race relations. So then it becomes a question of, are we trying to look at someone in totality and trying to go, well, okay, most of what they did was good. They did this one terrible thing. Can we excuse that? But it goes further with figures who are sort of this towering in the culture. Muhammad Ali, I almost compare a little bit to John Lennon. John Lennon has a real problematic history with women. I mean, his own kids have talked about remembering John Lennon hitting his wives, you know. But as a Beatles fan, and I'm one of these people, it's almost like we don't want that to even be part of the story. You know, with Ali, I think part of it had to do with his pure confidence, sort of his unadulterated bravado that forced those around him to sort of accept that, well, he's a progressive no matter what he says. You know, no matter what the message seems to be content-wise, we know as a figure he is the progressive. And over time, the progressives always succeed because, you know, the culture evolves too. And anybody with progressive ideas, no matter how strange they may seem at the time, are eventually going to seem completely valid.
Chuck Klosterman is with us, and he's talking about his new collection of essays called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Well, you know, not to mention that Muhammad Ali is an attractive man, and there is something that you point out here that a lot of Bernard Goetz, for example, who was for about 5 minutes, you know, a hero, the subway vigilante who shot four youths on a subway train in New York in the 1970s, doesn't make out so well, being a weird-looking guy. Linda Tripp, obviously, doesn't make out so well, not being a very attractive person, through no fault of her own. But how much do looks have to do with the perceived villainy?
Well, you know, I'm probably especially sensitive to this because I'm a very weird-looking person. And I think that if you're a weird-looking person, the understanding of how much handsomeness and sexuality plays in interpersonal culture is really maybe amplified. I have an essay in this book where I'm talking about, you know, the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation. Mm-hmm. And it would be very easy, I think, to say like, well, you know, why was Bill Clinton able to sort of have this event happen in his life, basically be the world's most famous philanderer for a period of time? He really, you know, in a weird way, you know, put the presidency at risk for this kind of one desire that he, again, had no emotional investment in. And of course, the first response somebody will have to that is, well, you know, that's just this double standard we have that men can get away with this and women can't, you know. And there's, you know, there's certainly some truth in that. But the attractiveness of Bill Clinton was a role in this as well. I don't think Nixon would be allowed to have had that kind of experience and been re-embraced not just by America as a whole, but specifically by women. That Christmas, he had the highest approval rating of his entire tenure as president.
Well, in addition to being a slightly weird looking, or let's just say a person who didn't care very much about his appearance, I'm going back to Bernard Goetz, just because
He talked. He filled himself out as a person. He let us know who he was and what his motivations were, which really turned everybody off. And you make that point here. It's the people who talk. It's the Wilt Chamberlain who talks about himself. It's Linda Tripp who decides to talk about herself. Is it better just to stay silent, to keep a heroic kind of poise?
You know, the silence is part of it, certainly. But it's almost even a larger abstraction. It's the idea that people don't know anything about you, so they can fill you kind of with whatever their pre-existing desire happens to be. You know, Bernard Goetz shoots people on a subway. Okay, initially, if you go up to anyone who's intellectual, somebody who has, a supposedly sophisticated view of culture and say, like, is vigilante justice acceptable? They will say no. You know, of course not. We have a framework for this. People need due process. You cannot allow an individual to decide what justice is. But then you give them a situation without many details. All you know is that there is this person in a city filled with crime, bothering no one, confronted by three potential criminals, and he kind of responds with violence. When that's all the information we have, it almost seems like he is acting as an agent for society, or maybe that he's making, you know, the world safer by, you know, shooting people in public. It seems paradoxical, but that's the initial sense of Bernard Goetz. The first 48 to 72 hours of those shootings, you really couldn't find anybody who had a problem with him. It was like he was an unknown hero. But once he comes forward and he says things like, I wanted to kill those guys. Shooting them was easier than typing. We start learning details about things he said at a community meeting that were potentially racist. We find these bizarre things about his life. For example, he still lives in New York in an apartment with squirrels in it because he's a big advocate for squirrels. You know, we learn all these sort of interesting details about him. But what that does is it makes his actions now seem personal. He no longer seems like he's an agent for society. He seems like an agent for himself. And that forces everyone to swing back to the original idea that you just can't let the lone gunman decide what is right and what is wrong.
You make the point in the book that we say thank you to the convenience store clerk so that we can be seen as the kind of people who say thank you, right? We're invested in people knowing what we like or dislike. So how much of the hero and the villain is a projection of how we want to be seen?
Oh, I think certainly almost all of it. This book is like all of my kind of essay collections. It's not as though I'm trying to persuade people to believe a certain thing about villains or heroes or anything. I'm not like that. I know that's kind of antithetical to criticism in some ways, but I have no desire to be like a tastemaker or to shape public opinion. I'm trying to explore these things on my own. Like, something's interesting in my life, and I feel like the best way for me to kind of work through my consciousness is kind of through writing about it. So, you know, a lot of this book has to do with my own fear that I am a bad person regardless of what I do. So a lot of what I think about in this book is not even what happened, but why it happened to begin with. Like, what was the intent? And then how is that intent sort of manipulated by the audience?
Okay, so how about just a quick little quiz? I'm going to ask you who is more villain.
Okay.
Taylor Swift or Eazy-E?
Well, Eazy-E is trying to project the image of badness. It is a conscious construction. Taylor Swift is attempting to create the illusion of purity. I would say Taylor Swift is probably closer to an actual villain than Eazy-E.
Okay, Julian Assange or Darth Vader?
Well, Julian Assange is absolutely convinced that what he is doing is more moral than what the mainstream media does. He is very much a believer that if you put information out, even if it harms one person or 10 people or 100 people, there's a value to that if it ends up saving the lives or transforming the lives of a million people. Darth Vader blew up planets arbitrarily. So I guess Darth Vader is more of a villain.
My earlier conversation with Chuck Klosterman about his book of essays, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. The book is now available in paperback.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Summer is fireworks season in America. Those glittering spectacles of light and sound draw celebratory applause and plenty of warnings about the danger of serious injury. But the thrilling proximity to exploding rockets has been with us since the Chinese invented gunpowder in the 7th century. The 13th century English friar Roger Bacon is the first European known to describe the gunpowder mixture that makes up firecrackers. But it wasn't until Elizabeth I's reign in the 16th century that public exhibitions of fireworks were recorded. Author and illustrator Ron Miller wrote in IO9 about the spectacularly dangerous fireworks displays that enthralled Europe centuries ago. We caught up with him and asked what they looked like.
Almost exactly like they look today. And in fact, many of the fireworks are more familiar things we see. You know, everything from pinwheels to fountains and things like that have been unchanged for, you know, almost 1,000 years.
How do we know that? How do we know how they looked?
Well, they could draw pictures back then.
Said the illustrator.
Exactly, which they did. And they really would look like drawings, maybe. So they may have made, you know, a 4th of July celebration, you know, today.
That was a question for me. There was no Bastille Day. There was no Guy Fawkes Day. When would a person have been able to see fireworks?
Kings had birthdays. That was coronations. Those were largely the excuses for doing these things. Also, they were the only people who could afford this sort of thing. Today, municipalities and towns and villages can afford these things. They get a big enough city, they can invest maybe $1 million in a fireworks display.
So you have records of these fireworks displays in Elizabethan England, or England even before that. But you write that things really took off in Italy. Why there, do you think?
Good question. I think maybe just natural Italian exuberance. There's also a family, the Ruggiero family, who became really, really experts in developing fireworks. They eventually moved to France, I think largely because money was there. But I think it was more just by accident than anything else that this one particular family became deeply involved in developing, you know, the art of fireworks.
I imagine the Italians also have the feast days for Catholic saints maybe cornered at that time.
Oh, sure. And in Mexico, for example, there are a number of feast days which are major public fireworks displays. I've been to one of those, and it's frightening because it's in the streets with the people running around carrying this towering wooden frames on their heads, you know, loaded with fireworks and rockets shooting down the streets, and it's pretty insane, but really pretty. but you have to be quick on your feet.
And were they public displays back in Europe as well, in medieval and Renaissance era Europe?
Well, it could be afforded. But at the time, it was really considered kind of a secret, too, both a military secret, and Bacon, when he rediscovered gunpowder in Europe, he had heard about it from the Chinese, announced the discovery in a code because, you know, he was scared to death what was going to become of this stuff.
What do you think of the artistry? You've seen these illustrations of early fireworks displayed. Certainly, they're spectacular, but do you think it's changed, gotten better, worse?
Oh, gotten better, certainly. I saw a video recently of, I think it was Bastille Day in Paris this year, and they were doing things that looked more like CGI anything that could possibly be done with fireworks. It's partly because, you know, it is an art form, and people are, you know, trying to be creative with it and develop new techniques, new materials, new patterns and shapes and colors. And so it's always evolving.
Ron, I want to thank you for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you.
Ron Miller is an author and an illustrator who wrote about the history of fireworks displays for IO9. You'll find a link to his original article at wordofmouthradio.org. In case you missed it, the comic book character Archie has died. He was felled by an assassin's bullet intended for his friend Kevin Keller, the first openly gay character in Archie Comics history. Archie Comics may be emblematic of small-town Americana at its most cornball,
But Archie's death has reverberated around the globe, all the way to Kolkata, India. Sandeep Roy remembers Archie and why the comic book high schooler connected with fans in India.
Archie died?
And this was big news this week.
I had no idea.
So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's huge. I can't believe they even did that.
A lot of us shared George Takei's incredulous reaction on What's Trending when Archie Andrews was shot to death last week, heroically saving his gay friend. But in India, some of us felt it a little bit more. We had a special relationship with Riverdale High. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. In fact, Archie Comics had apparently inspired a 1998 Bollywood blockbuster movie, a love triangle called Kuch Kuch Hota Hai, that begins in a college in Mumbai. In 2012, Archie Comics editor-in-chief Victor Gorelick explained to Comic-Con India at the San Diego Comic Convention why he thought Indians loved Archie.
Well, I think Archie does well in India because a lot of people like to see how the teenagers live here in America, what life is like here.
It's not that we could relate to the lifestyles of Archie and his gang. Our socialist India was too far removed from Riverdale High. We didn't have Pop Tate's chocolate shop or baseball games or redheads for that matter. As teenagers, we didn't drive second-hand cars, and we certainly did not learn how to fix them. Heck, we barely had something that passed as pizza, and Coca-Cola was still banned. But Riverdale High was even more of an escape than Bollywood films. For all their song and dance, chiffon and Alps fantasies, Bollywood films eventually drummed home the virtues of settling down, family, duty, and responsibility. In the never-never land of Riverdale High, nothing mattered other than girls, jalopies, pizzas, and baseball. Archie was quite unambitious, utterly sacrilegious in India, where every teenager seemed to be running from one tuition class to another, preparing for some kind of examination all the time. Class test, half-yearly, final exams, selections, board exams, entrance exams. In 2008, Riverdale High saw its first Indian-American character, camcorder-toting Raj Patel. Gorelick says it was about diversity. There were Latino characters and African-Americans, a gay character, and an Indian-American.
Well, we created Raj Patel because we certainly, as you know, we sell a lot of comic books over in India.
That's about a million copies in 2011. No wonder that year Archie and the gang came to Mumbai. Jughead chowed down on samosas in Vindaloo, and Veronica and Betty put on saris, and they all found everything about Mumbai amazing. Indian media, like Bollywood Now, gushed about which Indian star might play which Archie character.
News is that Bollywood sexy beauties Deepika Padukone might be considered to play Veronica, and Katrina Kaif would play the character of Betty in the comic book series.
Alas, even India couldn't save Archie. Globalization was the final death knell. There's nothing an Archie can serve up anymore that's not easily accessible to any teenager growing up in urban India. The American fantasy is available for sale at any mall in Kolkata. In fact, there's a chain store here called Archie's. Everything's Archie. It sells the quiche of teenage years, cutesy cards and coffee mugs and key rings. Apparently, this Archie's got its name from a neighbor's dog named Archie, not the American redhead. But perhaps the dog was named after the redhead. It doesn't matter. Long after the real Archie is dead and gone, a memory of him will remain alive in malls in India. The all-American teenager could not have found a more appropriate resting place. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there are plenty more stories and conversations at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked to Dr. Joy Rydenberg. She's the comparative biologist behind the new PBS series Sex in the Wild. Well, we showed our immaturity while learning some fascinating things about animals who reproduce in extreme conditions and how evolution has helped make the mating process easier.
Whales and dolphins have a penis that's actually hidden inside the body until they need it. So really what we're dealing with is a spring-loaded penis.
For more intriguing details on sex in the wild, you can visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And believe me, there is much more to the kangaroo's 36-day gestation period than you can imagine. And please, make like a marsupial and bounce it along to other animal lovers in your life. After all, the most fascinating tidbits travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.